Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We got jobs today. We got shutdown. We got the debt limit and Twitter. What do you got? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 4th of October. Great to have you with us, everybody. It's Jobs Report Day, of course, September unemployment. Expectations had been for a steady-as-she-goes kind of number. Not too hot, not too cold, not quite right, though, either, if the economy's really going to get going. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has the details.
Well, Kai, here on the trading floor, market players aren't too surprised by the jobs report. 180,000 new jobs and unemployment stuck at 7.3%. One told me, kind of mediocre, just like last month.
The economy today looks an awful lot like the economy yesterday. No individual number can fundamentally change the story.
That's University of Michigan economist Justin Wolfers, and this morning he tweeted out fake analysis of the jobs report, just like I invented at the top. There was no jobs report due to the government shutdown. Wolfers says if the data collectors stay off the job,
we'll have no idea of the effects of the budget battles on the economy. It's kind of ironic. The main effect of the government shutdown is going to be to make sure there's not enough data to figure out what the main effects of the government shutdown are.
So to reiterate, number of new jobs, not 180,000, unemployment, not 7.3%. For the record, we don't have a clue. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Laughing so we don't cry is what I think that is. There is much, much more to talk about on this fourth day of government interruptus. Here to wrap up the week on Wall Street and way beyond for us are John Carney from CNBC. He's in New York. Neela Richardson from Bloomberg Government is down in Washington. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, so Neela, let me ask you the first question, which is this. You know, Mitchell's report was fun and all, but it's kind of a big deal that we're starting to lose track a little bit of how the economy's doing.
Well, we know at least 800,000 government employees temporarily unemployed, that's for sure. Look, the unemployment report has I'm calling it the unemployment report now.
Yes.
The employment report has been somewhat lackluster. And I think the fake report is right. By all intents and purposes, I don't think we'd see a big sea change and a big boost in employment this month. However, I think that we have bigger fish to fry in the economy right now. The shutdown, the impending debt ceiling debates are much more problematic to the world economy, to the U.S. economy right now than this tepid jobs report that could have been put out today.
Or jobs rapport, if you will, Mitchell, paying homage there. Hey, John, so let me ask you this, just to spin off Anila's point about the debt limit and the shutdown. What are the odds you think that the shutdown now gets wrapped into the debt limit fight and we're here for another like 10 days?
I mean, we are there now, right? This week, there was no progress made at all in moving away from the shutdown. The debt limit is supposed to arrive hard and fast on October 17th. We're coming, you know, those two debates are smushed together whether or not the policymakers want them to be or not at this point. Because what are we going to do, solve this shutdown problem and then reopen all the same debates again about the debt limit? It's the same debate we're having right now.
All right, so Neela, climb in here and answer this question for me. Does rolling them all into one big ball of goo make it easier or harder to solve the underlying problem? Are we going to get that grand bargain out of this now that Speaker John Boehner is said to be talking about again?
If you believe the rhetoric, Kai, absolutely not. On one hand, you have President Obama saying that he will not negotiate over the debt ceiling. He wants a clean spending bill, meaning no attachments, no loopholes, and he wants a clean debt ceiling bill as well. So if you believe that, then no, it doesn't make it easier. It makes it quite a bit harder. And then it's complicated by the fact that Republicans don't seem to be on the same page about what kind of loopholes and riders and attachments they want to put to this bill. Is it defunding Obamacare? Is it the Keystone Pipeline, this oil and gas construction that they want? Is it reduction in entitlement reform? What is it? And until we see what it is and what the negotiation points can actually be, this looks really, really hard.
Hey, John, how come Wall Street's not going bananas over this? I mean, the Dow is up today. The 10-year Treasury is stuck solidly at 2.6%, hasn't changed in a week and a half. The markets are remarkably calm.
They're very calm. Traders I speak to are very calm. They're confident that we will not have some sort of, you know, default on the treasuries. They think, you know, when it comes down to it, one side or the other, probably the Obama administration will either pull some rabbit out of the hat trick that allows us to, you know, surprise, we don't have to default on our debt, or they will compromise, perhaps not on Obamacare, but on something like we're going to allow the Keystone Pipeline, give the Republicans a win, and then everybody can go away feeling like, you know, we kept Obamacare in place and we got the Keystone Pipeline. Huh. So there's a possible deal people have talked about.
Hey, Neely, do you think people in Washington, that is, are actually watching the markets? Are they keeping an eye on, like, the 10-year and the Dow?
I think there are certain segments, and in Washington, the Treasury in particular, that are definitely keeping their eye on the markets, particularly because this debt ceiling debate, according to the Treasury report released yesterday, could be financial Armageddon. So they should be if they're not. Yeah. But I think that markets have become kind of numbed to political dysfunction, which is probably good in the short term. In the long run, it says a lot about the fact that Washington needs to get its act together.
Yeah. Neela Richardson from Bloomberg Government, John Carney from CNBC. His blog is called Net Net. Thanks, you guys. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you,
Kai. Have a great weekend.
All right, you too. As I said, equities traders didn't even blink at the jobs report non-report. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, let's check the weather real quick before we go any farther, huh? We've got Tropical Storm Karen tracking toward the Gulf Coast. There's an early blizzard smacking the northern Great Plains. Santa Ana winds are coming to Southern California. They are hot and dry, making for prime wildfire conditions here. Perhaps not the best time for federal agencies like FEMA or the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, to be shut down, even partially. So we asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer just how essential those non-essential workers are when the weather is bad.
The crowded weather map comes at a very bad time for the federal agencies that deal with disasters. Most of the National Hurricane Center staff are deemed essential, but FEMA had to scramble to recall furloughed workers. Marshall Shepard is director of the Atmospheric Sciences Program at the University of Georgia. He says FEMA needs to prepare way ahead of time for storms and hurricanes.
The more lead time you have, the better. So you would have to think that furloughed workers being called back actually, you know, affects that response time.
Some meteorologists at the National Weather Service are considered non-essential and have been furloughed, among them Amy Fritz. She spoke at a press conference in Washington earlier this week.
I have built and developed the models that predict storm surge. And right now we're making critical improvements to those models.
The folks who run the Weather Service's Twitter feed aren't considered essential either, so it's frozen, even though it was a prime source of information during the recent Colorado floods. And the shutdown has led to extra bureaucratic burdens. Nancy Colleton is president of the Institute for Global Environmental Strategies.
But every expenditure that the National Weather Service is incurring during this period has to be approved by the Secretary of Commerce,
who oversees the Weather Service, but normally doesn't have to approve the cost of every weather balloon or hurricane hunting flight. But then again, these aren't normal times on the weather map or in Washington. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
We know more about Twitter today than we did yesterday. The company has taken the wraps off its plans for an initial stock offering. We know how much money it made last year, or lost, really. We know how much money its CEO makes, and we know how many monthly users the company has. 218 million, give or take. I say give or take because some of them are what are called bots, computer programs that automatically tweet and retweet, no humans required. Problem is that those bots get counted in the user totals, posing a challenge for advertisers and investors who might be considering whether to buy in. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has that story.
Robots used to be easy to spot. They were metal. They made funny robot sounds. But those carefree days of robot spotting are long gone. Online, on Twitter especially, bots and people look a whole lot alike. Dan Zarella is a social media researcher at HubSpot, which helps companies market online.
At first glance, a lot of these bots can be hard to identify. Like, if you only see one tweet, and it's constructed well and it's kind of clever and it's not something that all the other bots are doing, then yeah, it can be hard to tell.
In its IPO filing, Twitter estimates that 7% of its users have the ability to tweet automatically. i.e. could be bots. It estimates less than 5% of its users are false or spam accounts. All this matters because Twitter depends on ad revenue, and advertisers want to reach real people. Zachary Rees-Davis is an analyst at Forrester Research.
Twitter has never been a social network oriented around real-world identity.
I can be on Twitter as at Adrian Hill and at Kai Spoof and at pretty much anybody else.
Unlike Facebook and LinkedIn, with Twitter, a individual person can create as many different accounts as they would like, and many do.
And Twitter counts each one as a separate user. Any uncertainty about who marketers are reaching when they sponsor a tweet is a question that'll likely be repeated and retweeted in the run-up to the IPO. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Coming up, how far can you get on brains and hard work anyway?
PayPal, Intel, eBay, YouTube, so many entrepreneurs who came over here to this country with nothing and have built huge companies.
Pretty far then, huh? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 76 points today, 0.5%, closed at 15,072. The NASDAQ added 33 points. That's 0.9%, ended at 3807. The S&P 500 climbed 11 points, 0.7%, 1690 at the bell there. For the week that was, the Dow off 1.2%. The S&P 500 gave back 0.1%. The NASDAQ actually up 0.7% there. Facebook snapped up nearly 4% today on its plans to include advertising, beautiful ads, we are told, on its Instagram photo sharing service. The markets generally shook off shutdown worries today, but home builders did not. D.R. Horton, Lennar, and Toll Brothers all dropped around 3% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note, which is the thing to watch, really rose to 2.64%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Monday. The Federal Reserve is scheduled to release its monthly consumer credit report for August. The United Nations marks World Habitat Day with the theme Urban Mobility. And here's something to get all melty over. October is American Cheese Month. 31 days to celebrate cheese. Pace yourselves, people. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. It was hardly a flawless launch, but the healthcare exchanges are up and running in some states, surely better than in others. Our healthcare reporter Dan Gorenstein has been spending some time in Camden, New Jersey, watching the Affordable Care Act unfold on the ground. Today, a short-term progress report. Here's Dan.
It's October 4th, but out here it feels like August 4th. In between the bus stop and the train tracks is a small farmer's market. At the edge, Tony Cohen and Lindsay Carlson sit at a table covered with papers.
People just stop by, people see us in the street, and they go, oh, you're those girls from Project Hope. You know, you can help us sign up.
Welcome to the front lines of Obamacare. Carlson and Cohen are certified application counselors, the fancy way of saying they've been trained to help people sign up for health insurance. And in Camden County, there are 54,000 people who may be eligible. A woman in a fur-collared denim vest walks over. Tony Cohen offers her a paper application.
Can't you just do it on a computer? We can. However, the website is still down.
The website is still down. A popular phrase this week, says Carlson.
It's difficult. It's a little bit frustrating to tell somebody, oh, no, I'm sorry, we can't do it that way. I know we've been saying that we can.
The two women have helped just 20 people fill out paper applications in Camden. Cohen says the process takes about 15 minutes. She says it's going okay.
I mean, this is a step to getting health care. Like, I don't want to dismiss that the paper application is a waste of time. Like, it is the first step. But yes, there is paperwork to follow, and no, it's not as quick as online.
The other problem? You can't find out if you qualify for financial assistance, or even what the plans look like and how much they cost. Then comes the really tricky part. Cohen says you've got to follow up with the person in a few weeks once they've gotten a response from the federal government. In the meantime, Cohen and Carlson will keep staking out the farmers market and hoping the 21st century shows up soon. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Part of what makes this country, is the long-held belief that people rise and fall by their talent, that no matter your pedigree, anybody can make it with brains and hard work. Whether that plays out in reality is a whole nother question, but if you're looking for some place that gets the idea of meritocracy better than most, Silicon Valley is a good option. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark went up to the Valley of the Self-Made Millionaire to see what they're getting right and maybe not so right.
Meritocracy has become part of Silicon Valley's unofficial brand. People like to wear hoodies and sneakers, not stuffy suits. Office decor is meticulously unpretentious, like Steve Jobs' childhood garage, but shinier.
Open warehousey space, no cubes, there's a lot of happy hours.
That's Sarah Lacey, a journalist turned entrepreneur who founded Pando Daily, a media startup that covers startups. We met at her office in a San Francisco startup incubator, and it was fully tricked out in meritocracy chic.
A lot of bean bags, couches. This is the igloo.
What happens in the igloo? Why is there an igloo?
It's just an alternative meeting room.
Alternative meeting rooms, igloos, bean bags. They're goofy, but they're meant to send an important message that this is a place of irreverence. Anti-hierarchy. Values that, Lacey says, have made Silicon Valley one of the most meritocratic industries on Earth.
I would challenge anyone to find an economic ecosystem that's more of a meritocracy than Silicon Valley. I mean, let's go down the list. PayPal, Intel, eBay, YouTube. So many entrepreneurs who came over here to this country with nothing and have built huge companies.
This conviction of Silicon Valley's meritocracy credentials is something you hear a lot. Here's Michael Arrington, angel investor and founder of the website TechCrunch, being interviewed on CNN.
Generally speaking, it doesn't matter what your education is. It doesn't matter who your parents are here. You can become very successful based purely on your brain size and how you use it.
And here's Peter Bell, a prominent venture capitalist, being interviewed on TechCrunch.
What's really special about the Valley is the optimism that no matter where you come from, you can start a company, you can join a startup, you can change the world.
A favorite example of the anyone can make it here narrative is
Max Levchin, the PayPal founder.
Sarah Lacey knows the story by heart.
Moved from the Soviet Union when he was 16. His family had $300 in their pocket and had to learn English by watching an old television set that he pulled out of a dumpster and repaired. 10 years later or so, he sold a company for $1.5 billion. I mean, ask someone like Max Levchin, who had that amazing, very American experience, do you consider this place meritocracy?
My name is Max Levchin. I am a perennial entrepreneur.
So I did ask Max Levchin. But first, I wanted to make sure that the story that gets told about him was right.
Yeah, that's remarkably accurate. The only thing I'm not sure is the amount of dollars we had in our pocket. It may have been 400 or 200. I don't quite remember anymore. But everything else is pretty much correct, including the TV story.
So do you think Silicon Valley is a meritocracy?
I think on the absolute scale, it seems quite meritocratic. I've met lots of people that have succeeded independent of their humble or otherwise origins.
But Levchin told me there are a few details of his story that often get left out. For one, even though his parents couldn't afford a TV.
My family was very supportive of the idea that having access to a personal computer would do something good for me. And within a few weeks of landing in the United States, they gave me a PC to work on, to play with and to explore.
Levchin says it also helped that his mother was actually a computer programmer, and his father, grandfather, and grandmother were physicists, prominent ones. In fact, that list you heard a minute ago of all those big tech companies with immigrant founders, nearly every one of them had parents who were scientists, too.
I actually ponder this a lot, especially in the context of interviewing people to come work for companies that I helped start.
A big part of entrepreneurial success involves confidence, Levchin says, and knowing how to work hard for a faraway goal.
The academic background that my family had, I think, had a big influence on that in my case. They basically told me, look, you need to spend a lot of time just chiseling skills that will eventually pay off in a big way. When I try to interview young people, I look for that family ethic of extraordinarily hard work without immediate payoff.
And maybe that sounds strange to hear one of the poster boys of Silicon Valley meritocracy say that when he's interviewing someone for a job, he thinks about their family background. But it also makes some sense, says Eric Reese, another Silicon Valley entrepreneur. He happens to come from a long line of doctors.
In the venture investing world, they call it the ability to have good pattern recognition, to see things that have worked in the past and try to find those same combination of factors in the future.
Pattern recognition can be useful, says Reese, but it has risks. There's this joke in Silicon Valley that everyone is looking for the next Mark Zuckerberg.
Sometimes you wind up looking for a guy who looks like Mark Zuckerberg physically and talks like him and wears the same kind of clothes he wears. In fact, one of our famous investors recently told a story about investing in someone who turned out to be not very good and then thinking to themselves, how could I have been fooled by this guy? Oh, because he looked like Mark Zuckerberg. That's not merit-based selection.
These sorts of unconscious biases could help explain why just a tiny fraction of the startups that get major funding in Silicon Valley are founded by women or African Americans, says Reese. And then there's the pipeline issue. That PC that Max Levchin's parents scraped up money to buy him when he was a teenager, Reese says that is a very common story.
All the nerds that made right in Silicon Valley, you know, bullied, not popular kids in school, whatever. What we all have in common, or almost all of us, we had a computer at home. We could kind of go home on our own, tinker with it, fall in love with it, learn how to program it. I think about this all the time. What would have happened to me if I didn't have that access, if I didn't have that outlet? Would I have been as successful as I am today? I don't know.
Of course, today, millions of kids don't have their own computers. And sure, creating a perfect meritocracy in any industry is complicated. But Reese says finding a way to get every nerdy kid in America a computer at home, that could be a good next step. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
There's a little irony to add to your government shutdown news today. Even as NASA has furloughed 97% of its workforce, there's a big movie about space opening in theaters everywhere, Gravity, with Sandra Bullock and George Clooney. Wesley Morris, who writes on film for Grantland, is here to discuss. Hey, Wesley, good to talk to you, man.
Nice to talk to you, Kai. What's going on?
First of all, what'd you think of the thing? I will confess, I'm a space geek, and I am very much looking forward to seeing this movie.
Then your mind is going to explode because it, from a physics standpoint and from an astronautic standpoint, it is apparently, my being neither one of those things, it is apparently very good and very plausible. And there are some liberties taken, apparently, but for me as a movie-going experience, this is a very good directing performance by Alfonso Cuarón, who made Children of Men and Y Tu Mamá También and Harry Potter's The Prisoner of Azkaban.
He actually said, and this to me was the most interesting part of this movie, he says you can't watch it like a regular movie. What does that mean?
Well, he hasn't made a movie in 7 years. Yeah. And so the last time he made a movie, we weren't watching them on our phones. So he has made a movie that is virtually phone proof in that it helps to be sensorily overwhelmed by the 3D, by the great sound design, by the cinematography, by the visual effects. He's made a complete movie-going experience and put at the center of it these two very excellent movie stars.
Couple of technical questions, not technical engineering, but technical about the movie questions. One, this is 3D, and it's everything I've read about it says this movie had to be in 3 because of space and how objects move. Do you agree? And could it revitalize the somewhat overdone 3D-ness of movies these days?
Oh, God, I hope not.
Well,
I think this should be a really good example of a movie that should make other people say, well, we shouldn't bother if there's no reason for it. I think if you can find a way that's not just throwing things at your face for 2 hours or doing that horrible thing that you and I have talked about before where they shoot the movie in standard definition and then they retrofit it for 3D so it looks terrible.
Item number two, Sandra Bullock. Not apparently the first choice for this movie, but does an amazing job and kind of earned it.
Yes. I could think of other actresses who would have been better in this movie, but of she's the best movie star for this kind of part.
Did it have to be a movie star?
Probably not. No, but I mean, there's a degree to which you kind of want something that is certifiably bankable. So you have these two very bankable people, you know, in Sandra Bullock, an extremely bankable person, and George Clooney, just a very good movie star who is occasionally bankable. I'm sure I'm going to get a call from the George Clooney people in about 10 minutes.
Occasionally bankable.
But if you stack Sandra Bullock's numbers up next to George Clooney's, I think her stack of dollars is a little bit higher.
Seriously?
I'll do the math on that and get back to you, but I'm pretty sure I'm correct.
Wesley Morris, he writes at Grantland. Wesley, thanks a bunch.
Thank you, Kai. And congratulations on your Emmy, by the way.
Thank you, man. All right, now we need to do that. I'd leave that in there, but I can't. You know, maybe we should leave it in there.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which we learn exactly how important ticker symbols really are. We told you yesterday that Twitter is going to trade under the symbol TWTR, which kind of makes sense. Twitter, TWTR. TWTR, however, is not the same stock as TWTRQ, which is the ticker symbol for a defunct consumer electronics company called Tweeter Home Entertainment. Q gets tacked on when a company files for bankruptcy. So why am I telling you all that? Because today, 5 million shares of TWTRQ changed hands. It closed up 684% at just over a nickel a share. Caveat emptor, people. Read the fine print. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace on a Friday from American Public Media. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yor. It's produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you next week, everybody. Have a good weekend. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.